Today, Home Lending, the next shoe to drop. The DFA Daily to the 9th of July 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a little philosophy on the side. You can tell things are bad when the ABS suspends the trends series of lending flow data, as they did starting from March 2020. They say the trends series will be reinstated when more certainty emerges in the underlying trends in lending flows. The value of new loan commitments fell for both owner-occupiers and investors during May, and the value of new loan commencements accepted by investors reached its lowest level since November 2002. And May's fall in the value of new loan commitments for the purchase of existing dwellings was the largest monthly fall in the series, which started way back in July 2002. The fall in unoccupied commitments in May was driven by falls in New South Wales and Victoria. That said, there were falls reported for all the other states except the ACT. The fall in new loan commitments for investors was also driven by Victoria and New South Wales. And the value of loan commitments accepted by owner-occupiers remained significantly higher than loan commitments accepted by investors. And there was strong growth in the value of fixed interest loans funded in April and May, driven by refinancing activity. And in May, the number of owner-occupied first home buyer loan commitments decreased 9.3% in season-adjusted terms, and the number of first home buyer loan commitments for investment purposes accounted for just 4.6% of all first home buyer commitments in original terms, and unoccupied first home buyer loan commitments accounted for 31.7% of all owner-occupied commitments, excluding refinances, in original terms. And new loan commitments for owner-occupied first home buyers fell by a similar proportion to the overall fall in owner-occupied commitments for dwellings. New South Wales and Queensland drove the fall in the number of loan commitments accepted by owner-occupied first home buyers. All other states except the ACT recorded falls, and there is still a small number of first-time buyers going direct to the investment sector. While reduced transactions in the housing market stifled new loan activity in May, the value of existing owner-occupied loans refinanced with a different bank was by far the highest on record as borrowers responded to reduced interest rates and refinancing offers. And the value of new loan commitments for fixed-term personal finance rose 14.5% in May, season-adjusted, following a 24.8% fall in April. The HIA commented that it is difficult to draw conclusions from this data other than there's been a material disruption to the housing market. HomeBuilder, along with other state incentives and an easing of restrictions, will assist in bringing consumers who delayed their purchasing decisions back to the market, they said. This will minimise the adverse impact of the COVID-19 shock on employment in the home building sector, but this will not be reflected in ABS data for some months. HIA new home sales for June will be the first indicator of the impact of home builder on the housing market. But standing back on this, you can see that loans are down. There are massive amounts of refinancing from one lender to another lender, fighting, of course, to get those loans, and people benefiting from cheaper rates. But this is going to lead, I think, to yet more home price falls because the rate of change of credit is one of the key levers that actually drives prices higher or lower. And their recent changes suggest lower. So watch this space. And in fact, wherever you look, we see more evidence of pressure on the property sector. For example, Domain reported that Australia's unit rental market has suffered its biggest price drop in more than 15 years as COVID-19 bites landlords and tenants alike. Domain's rent report for the June quarter shows that over 3 months, the national price for renting a unit dropped to $447 a week, making a historic plunge of 3.2%. Rental prices for housing suffered a more mild fate, falling just 1.2% to a record national median of $446 a week. Domain senior research analyst Dr. Nicola Powell said that while there were rent price falls across the country, it was inner city markets that were hit hardest by COVID-19. The rental market has become highly fragmented in recent months, with weaker conditions for units compared to houses. Tenants have a better chance of nabbing a cheaper unit, she said. Rental prices fell across most major capitals, illustrating no city was immune from the impact of coronavirus, with Sydney and Hobart units recording the steepest quarterly falls on record. Hobart suffered heavily, while Adelaide and Darwin remained flat. This weakness has been led by significant rent reductions in Sydney and Melbourne, inner city areas due to a surge in advertised rentals from March to June. In Australia's most expensive property market of Sydney, the median asking price for a unit plunged 3.8% over the quarter to $500 a week, and houses in Sydney made no move, staying at an average of $530 a week. In Melbourne, where residents are bunkering down for another 6 weeks of restrictions, house rental prices dropped 2.3% to a median of $430 a week, while units dropped 3.5% to a median of $415 a week. Tenants now have the novelty of choice. The rapid rise in advertised rentals have put pressure on rents, Dr. Powell said. Tenants are using this as bargaining power to negotiate a deal with landlords, compete to lure them. The steepest falls came in Hobart. In just 3 months, the median asking price for house rentals dropped 4.3% to $450, while the asking price for a unit rental dropped a staggering 8.4% to $380 a week. Rental houses in Canberra fell 0.9% at $575 a week, while units plunged 2.1% at $470 a week. In Brisbane, houses fell 2.4% to $400 a week, and units dropped 1.3% to $380 a week. In Perth, asking prices for rental houses dropped 1.3% to $370, while units remained flat at a median of $320 a week. And in Adelaide and Darwin, no movements were made on the asking rental prices of either houses or units. Dr. Powell said Melbourne is particularly exposed to risk compared to many other capital cities. Though international border closures have weakened demand, Melbourne is particularly exposed to a drop in overseas migration, student population and tourism, as a significant proportion of rental demand comes from overseas. This is particularly evident in the CBD, which also has a greater exposure to the industries most vulnerable to the job losses associated with the coronavirus pandemic and has a high proportion of households renting. In turn, Melburnians could see a further drop in rental prices. Vacancies are likely to remain high in the coming months across metropolitan and tourist areas, which could result in further rent reductions, Dr. Powell said. Any potential renewed short-term demand from interstate travel has been curtailed as Melbourne enters a second lockdown. And if you followed my post on Tuesday, you will know that mortgage stress and rental stress and investor stress are very, very high in and around Melbourne 3000. So I do expect more falls ahead. And in the retail space, the Financial Review says that the out-of-touch private landlords unwilling to adjust rents in the face of extreme rental headwinds and a global pandemic are driving retailers out of premier suburb shopping strips in droves, the Australian Retailers Association says. New research shows vacancy rates hit record levels of more than 20% on Melbourne's Chapel Street and Bridge Street, Richmond, in June, while in Sydney, hundreds of shops are available for lease in Oxford Street, Paddington, Newtown's King Street, and other inner suburbs. The chief executive of the association, Paul Zara, said retail strip landlords were living in a different world and relying on historical rent markers when setting rents. They have continued to hike up rents with a focus on yields and with annual rent increases baked into contracts, said the former David Jones boss. With more retail sales moving online and tenants in Melbourne set to come under further pressure from a six-week lockdown, a massive readjustment in rents was required, or it would become unviable for many retailers on retail strips. Discretionary spending is under the most pressure. These retailers to spend on foot traffic, which is just not around, he said. According to new on-foot analysis by real estate advisory firm Plan One Project Management, Melbourne's 11 main retail strips had average vacancy rates of more than 12.3% in June, up from about 8% 2 years ago. Of the 11 strips surveyed, 9 of them showed increases compared with a year ago. Plan One, led by former Knight Frank Victorian Research Director Richard Jenkins, only counted shops vacant if they were empty or for lease. Shops temporarily closed due to COVID-19 were excluded. Among the worst performing was Chapel Street, South Yarra, that hit a record high of 21% in June, up from 15.6% a year ago, and a previous high of 17%. Bridge Street in Richmond had the highest vacancy rate, with a record 22% of its shops empty, while 6 more strips, including Burke Road, Toorak, Glenferry Road, and Aisland Street, all had vacancies of 10% or higher. Among the better performing strips, Church Street, Brighton, recorded the lowest vacancy rate at 4.6%, up from 2.3%, while Puckle Street, Mooney Ponds and High Street, Armadale, both recorded vacancies of around 7%. Underscoring Mr. Ozara's concerns about out-of-touch landlords, Mr. Jenkins said, Chapel Street still had the highest rental level of between $800 and $1,500 per square metre, though rising vacancy was putting downward pressure on rents across all the strips. The trends of slowing retail trade growth has also adversely impacted individual retailers, with more than 800 stores closing as 10 retail brands fell into voluntary administration since the start of 2020, he said. In addition, online retail trade in Australia continues to take a larger share of overall spending. With the second lockdown in Melbourne running for 6 weeks, vacancies could rise even higher on Chapel Street and other strips. Christy Mouse, general manager of the Chapel Street precinct, which represents more than 2,200 businesses in South Yarra, Windsor and Paran, said 12 businesses closed permanently over the first lockdown. Foot traffic fell 85% last time, and I feel it will be the same this time around, she said. But then, millennial home buyers are still taking the property bait, or, according to a new report from ING, taking advantage of the weaker housing market brought about by the COVID-19 pandemic to achieve their ownership goals. ING says almost half, 46%, of millennial homebuyers say COVID-19 has made home ownership more achievable, while a third, 32%, say they will buy a house within the next 1 to 2 years. According to the report, millennials are using the lockdown to get on top of their property goals by redirecting travel budgets to a home savings account, 59%, taking on a side hustle, 37%, and moving back in with their parents at 36%. What this research suggests is that millennials and Australians in general haven't given up on the great Australian dream of owning their own home. They're just rethinking how they're going to get there and re-evaluating where they might want to live, ING said. Remember, they are one of the top 10 mortgage lenders in Australia, so of course no conflicts there. It suggests many people, especially millennials, are being savvy by taking advantage of record low interest rates, government assistance, and a weakened housing market to get on the property ladder. Well, maybe. Or maybe that's a bit of spin. The Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority Chairman Wayne Byers confirmed the regulator would classify all loans that were deferred or restructured as performing up till the 31st of March for reporting purposes. And they've written to ADIs today saying that ADIs should ensure that they take a prudent approach to the assessment and management of loans with repayment deferrals. At a high level, APRA expects that ADIs will first develop a comprehensive plan for how they will manage the borrower assessment process, including enhancements that need to be made to oversight, borrower review processes, customer engagement capabilities and resourcing. This should be approved by the relevant accountable person and provided to APRA and the Australian Securities and Investments Commission by the end of August 2020. They should conduct an appropriate credit assessment process to review borrowers' particular circumstances and determine the appropriate lending decision, returning to performing, restructure, extension or deferral period or default impairment. And they should monitor, manage and report on loans that have been restructured or granted a repayment deferral to ensure the risk of these loans is clearly understood and closely tracked at a portfolio and a loan level. And they should ensure adequate policies, procedures, resourcing and systems are in place to monitor arrears and for problem loan management during a period of heightened activity, including collection strategies, collateral management and hardship support. And they should reliably measure and record the impact of repayment deferrals on provisions and regulatory capital, and consider the forward-looking implications for risk profile, capital projections and stress testing. These measures, they say, are designed to incentivize ADIs to continue to support their customers through an extended period of uncertainty, while at the same time facilitating the restructure of eligible loans in a measured and timely manner, Mr. Byers said. And ADIs choosing to apply this alternative capital treatment will be required to, as well as report to APRA, provide public disclosures on the extent and nature of loans granted, repayment deferrals, and information regarding loans that have been restructured. APRA will issue specific requirements or minimum expectations for these disclosures in the coming weeks, and the decision to extend the payment holidays has been viewed by some as merely kicking the can further down the road, while others interpret the measure as an indication of deteriorating asset quality. Moody's Vice President Daniel Yu said the decision to extend the policy was not necessarily good news and indicated the number of customers needing additional support was not insignificant. The action highlights the large number of borrowers that have been impacted by the current economic disruption, significantly raising risks for Australian bank asset quality, he said. And UBS analyst Jonathan Mott said that although the decision to add an extra 4 months to the deferral period was expected, extending and pretending the loans would come good was not prudent, saying analysts would use APRA data to model the number of loans that were not being paid back. We believe it is difficult to argue that any loan that has not met scheduled repayments for 10 months has not seen a significant increase in credit risk and therefore should be treated as a non-performing loan, Mr. Mott said. And that really is the point. You can paper over the cracks for so long, but eventually a bad loan is a bad loan is a bad loan. And despite what the regulators do and say, these risks are definitely going to surface. Now, over in the UK, the UK Finance Minister, Rishi Sunak, has unveiled another £38 billion worth of coronavirus stimulus packages aimed at stemming Britain's growing job crisis and lifting the economy out of its worst slump in centuries. Now, it's worth studying this, as it may give some clues to what Frydenberg may do later in the month here. Speaking in Parliament on Wednesday, Sunak said that significant job losses are the most urgent challenge the UK economy faces, as he announced a package of tax breaks, restaurant discounts and job programmes designed to bolster employment as the government prepares to withdraw wage subsidies in October. The coronavirus pandemic has plunged Britain into its worst recession in 300 years, with the economy on track to shrink by 14% this year, according to the Bank of England. It also has fewer than 6 months to sign a new trade deal with the European Union, its biggest export market. The spending announced on Wednesday brings the government stimulus layouts to roughly £166 billion, or 7.4% of 2019 GDP, according to Paul Dales, chief UK economist at Capital Economics. While he doesn't expect economic output to fully recover until early 2022, Dales said the scale of direct fiscal support injected into the economy by the UK government now rivals that of Germany at 7.3% of 2019 GDP, Japan at 7.5%, and the United States at 8.4%, and surpasses government support in France and Italy, both at 4.5%. No one can accuse Sunak of penny pinching, he adds. Businesses will get a £1,000 bonus for each employee they bring back from furlough, costing the government up to £9 billion if employers bring back all 9 million workers enrolled in the wage support programme, Sunak said. The plan also includes a £2 billion programme to create and support new jobs for people under the age of 25, who Sunak said are 2.5 times as likely to work in sectors that have been closed by the pandemic. Under the plan, employers will be able to offer government-subsidised 6-month work placements to young people who are claiming unemployment benefits. According to the Treasury, a quarter of a million more people under 25 have claimed unemployment benefits since March. The United Kingdom faces a growing jobs crisis, with major companies already having cut more than 80,000 jobs, with more expected when the Jobs Retention Programme, which currently supports nearly 30% of the employed, is wound down in October. Jobless claims reached 2.8 million in May, more than double the number in March, according to the Office of National Statistics. And the unemployment rate has so far remained low, but it could soar to nearly 15% in the fourth quarter if there is a second coronavirus outbreak, according to the OECD. Even without an additional outbreak, the jobless rate is expected to be nearly 10% at year end, the Paris-based agency said earlier this month. And furlough has been a lifeline for millions, but it cannot and should not go on forever, Sunak said on Wednesday, adding that it will be wound down flexibly and gradually. A total of £1.6 billion will be invested in training, apprenticeships and scaling up employment support measures, including doubling the number of work coaches to 27,000, Sunak said. In an effort to protect the 2.4 million jobs that depend on hospitality and tourism, Sunak said he was cutting VAT from 20 to 5% for 6 months, which is, of course, like Australia's GST. To boost demand further, meals at participating restaurants, cafes or pubs will be discounted by up to £10 per head from Monday to Wednesday for the month of August, a programme Sunak dubbed Eat Out to Help Out. A tax on home purchases has been removed for properties costing under £500,000 until the end of March, raising the threshold from the current £125,000. And the finance minister also announced a £3 billion green investment package, which could help support around 140,000 jobs. And it includes grants for homeowners to make green improvements to their homes and money to make public buildings more energy efficient. The measures could help the United Kingdom meet its 2050 target of net zero carbon emissions. And about £5.8 billion will be spent on construction projects, including new schools, hospital maintenance, roads and housing, in line with the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's promise to build, build, build and level up Britain with increased investment in regions outside London. And finally, in a cautionary note, the World Health Organization confirmed that there is emerging evidence of airborne transmission of the coronavirus following the publication of a letter on Monday signed by 239 scientists that urged the agency to be more forthcoming about the likelihood that people can catch the virus from droplets floating in the air. Dr. Benedetta Allegresi, the World Health Organization technical lead for infection prevention and control, said during a briefing yesterday that the agency had discussed and collaborated with many of the scientists who signed the letter. We acknowledge that there is emerging evidence in this field, as in other fields regarding the coronavirus 19 and pandemic, and therefore we believe that we have to be open to this evidence and understand its implications regarding the modes of transmission and also regarding the precautions that need to be taken. Infection disease epidemiologist Maria Van Kerkhove with the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Program said many of the letter signatures were engineers, which adds to growing knowledge about the importance of ventilation, which we feel is very important. We have been talking about the possibility of airborne transmission and aerosol transmission as one of the modes of transmission of COVID-19, as well as droplet. We've looked at fomites, we've looked at fecal-oral, we've looked at mother-to-child, we've looked at animal-to-human, of course, as well, she said. She said that the agency is working on a scientific brief summarising the current knowledge around transmission of the deadly virus, which should be available in the coming weeks. And the point here is that this virus has a knack of being able to spread multiple ways, and it's clear that we have yet to fully understand all of that. And as I keep saying, all of the efforts to try and support economic recovery is predicated on getting the virus under control. And it's clear to me that there's a lot of work to do just on the basics to understand how the virus is transmitted and therefore how it can be controlled. A very salutary message given what's happening in Victoria at the moment, and the risks, of course, of wider transmission across Australia. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.